Hello and welcome to this IASB podcast. My name is Robert Bruce and I'm a financial journalist. With me today to discuss the May 2011 board meeting of the IASB are board member Steve Cooper and IASB Director of Technical Activities, Alan Teixeira. And this was, in part, a joint meeting with both IASB and FASB. Steve, can we start with insurance and just talk us through what decisions have been made and where we're going on that?
Thanks, Robert. Well, there was really one major issue that we discussed at this meeting, and perhaps one of the biggest issues to do with insurance, and that is how we deal with the margin in an insurance contract. You remember that we've got a method that involves an explicit estimate of cash flows, discounting something which is updated, so a forward-looking measure for an insurance liability. But the key question is what to do with the profit, the margin that will arise, so the difference between the premium and the present value of those cash flows. And this has been an issue all the way through. The IASB and the FASB reached different conclusions with the ED and discussion paper, respectively, that were issued. And it's whether you split it into two margins or you keep it as one. So the two-margin approach is identifying an explicit risk margin and then remeasuring that, the balance of the margin then becomes a residual margin, which is run off on some logical basis. Generally, that would be over the coverage period. The composite margin, the single margin approach, would be not to differentiate a separate amount of risk. Risk, of course, would be implicit in the composite margin itself, and then recognize that composite margin on a systematic basis. Originally in the FASB discussion paper, the recognition of the composite margin was based upon a type of formula, and it would be recognized partly over the coverage period, partly over the claims handling period. The composite margin recommendation changed for this meeting to one of running it off based on release from risk. Now, of course, if the composite margin is run off on the basis of release from risk, and we have a separate risk margin in the alternative approach, well, of course, the two are much closer together. So although the two methods are closer, they're not the same, and the two boards had to decide between them, and we actually reached different conclusions consistent with where we were originally for the exposure draft and discussion paper. So the IASB concluded that we should have the two-margin approach, the risk margin that was supported by a large majority of the IASB. There was some concern about the subjectivity of the measurement, and there was some discussion about disclosures and what additional things or maybe constraints on how you would do it, and the staff are going to come back with that. The FASB voted for an approach that we use a single margin, again consistent with what they'd done in the past. And also these two positions are quite consistent with the feedback. There was very much a geographic divide, with North America predominantly supporting a composite margin approach and outside predominantly supporting risk margin approach. Obviously, there was some variation around that. So the staff are going to investigate how we might make the two approaches more comparable through disclosures. As I said, there's quite a lot of comparability simply because of the runoff of the composite margin being based upon a release from risk, but it's not being measured. But the staff are going to come back with ways in which we might make them more comparable through additional disclosures. But disappointing that we got to a different decision. But as I say, this is one of the key elements and where we have had a disagreement in the past.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to leasing. Alan, where are we on leasing?
Thanks, Robert. It was a big month this month because I guess there were four major things that we had to look at. One major decision to do with lessee accounting, so that's if you're the one actually taking in this asset and using it. And then three issues that we looked at for lessor accounting. So perhaps we'll look at the lessee accounting first. And fundamentally, there was the difficulty there is that we've been having a look at situations where people have been leasing equipment, for example, perhaps without wanting to over-categorise it, but on a short term, or else their property is one of the biggest issues here. When you're leasing a couple of floors in a building and people perceive that that's slightly different to the sort of thing where you perhaps lease to own, where in essence you're buying it but the financing is through a leasing agreement. And they see that the idea of just simply separating a finance component out of the payments. When you're leasing a building, yes, there's a finance component, but it's not there. That's not everything that you're paying for. So we've been looking and investigating to see whether or not we should categorise the leases from a lessee's perspective into essentially what, you know, the lease-to-own type of agreement. So it's as close as you can call it, the old financing or capital type lease. And whether it's appropriate for those things that we've traditionally called operating leases to have some sort of even allocation in terms of the profit and loss. The basic idea, though, is everything's on balance sheet, and that's very important.
Yeah.
Now, we've been working through those. The difficulty is that whatever you do, you're going to have to, and I think the way the board members saw it is compromised somewhere. You either have to retain the integrity, in other words, to force the income statement to have an equal allocation. You have to retain the integrity of the lease liability of the or the asset. And really, any other option people had to look at was to try and use OCI or other comprehensive income to get an even allocation through there. I think the boards were quite divided on this. Some people just do not see that there's a difference at all between the nature of these lease agreements or the types of leases. So just did not want to differentiate at all. Others were concerned about what compromises we were introducing or the integrity of the assets and liabilities, etc. And certainly, there was one very clear signal. The boards, both boards, did not want to use OCI for this. They saw that as being inappropriate. So what it's come down to is that the boards have decided that we should revert back towards the exposure draft, and that is that all leases basically will be capitalised, and that you should identify and separate the financing component from the payments against the lease obligation. Now, having said that, one of the things that as they've been developing the decisions, and of course all these decisions are, you know, they're kind of like driving the direction rather than finite decisions, but we've always had this sort of 1 year exception where basically you don't have to put anything onto the balance sheet for short term leases, and that's fairly arbitrary, but simply 1 year or less. We're going to have a look at that again, and the staff have been asked to go back and have a look to see. You know, I think there's some board members, and from my recollection of the vote, it was something like, it was only a few, but two or three on either side would actually prefer longer than a year and thought maybe two or three years was appropriate for an exception. Mm-hmm. Others saw it as 1 year as being arbitrary and would prefer to have a materiality issue. And then it's really difficult because what does materiality really mean? They're worried about the work involved in separating a finance component, and probably more so the work involved in separating any perceived services that are bundled into these things. So we're going to have a look at that again, and I guess we have to ask the basic questions. The exception we've got now was to keep them completely off balance sheet, so there's nothing. But the staff have been asked to look at whether or not they should be gross. In other words, you just simply capitalise or put on the books the sum of the payments, and then recognise that an equivalent asset. Mm. So it still remains an open question, but I think fundamentally moved away from this notion of trying to just force an equalisation on the income statement.
If I can just say something on the straight lining and the whole issue of the lessee model. As Alan says, we reconfirmed what was in the exposure draft, and that does mean that for a single lease there is a front-end loading of the expense, because the interest being higher early on than later. We looked at all these methods of trying to get to a straight line, but nothing really seemed to stack up conceptually, and we had problems, you know, whichever approach we adopted. I think it's important to note, though, that in the vast majority of cases, because companies have a large number of leases all at different ages, the actual impact is, in most cases, very small. So we're not talking about sort of a major issue in terms of the income statement in the vast majority of cases. It does produce a transition problem, which we were aware of at the time of the issue of the ED, and we do need to fix that, given that we're now going for the ED approach and the staff are working on that. And also, of course, we can provide some disclosures that would effectively give what the straight line payment would be, what the straight line allocation would be. So again, staff are going to look at the disclosures as a consequence of the decision that we've taken. So I know this decision will disappoint some. When we did the outreach on this, many companies thought that the straight lining would be a valuable change to make. Many others didn't. The firms, many of the national standard setters I know were very against it because they thought conceptually it was difficult to justify. So we've gone in that direction, but are conscious of the impact of that decision. So staff are going to look at this from a disclosure perspective.
Yeah, because one of the difficulties in giving a what looks like a concession is that we're actually making the bookkeeping even more complicated for this group than for some of the other ones. And often the idea of concession is to help people. So we were tending to help the people, the users, the investors who wanted this information, but we were potentially penalising the preparers. And so that, as Steve said, disclosure is perhaps a better route for this one. So again, but we're very conscious what we don't want people to end up doing is having a horrendous job and sorting out the relatively short-term leases. So we are just looking at this towards the short end of the scale to see if we can help with some concessions. Leah, lessor accounting now.
Yes.
It is. Three issues here. The first is that, again, the two types of leases in a way. We've settled on those things that are typically what we call the financing leases and confirm the accounting for that, which is basically what we call a 4D recognition. So very similar to current requirements. The issue is on the other ones, and that's where not all of the risk and rewards of ownership are transferred to the lessee. For shorthand for our purposes, you think about the traditional operating leases. So it's essentially the lessor has got an asset and leases it out to somebody short term and then gets it back again. What do you do with those? And again, the boards are split on this, and the FASB's clear preference is to retain. They prefer a performance obligation, which was in the ED, but essentially they're looking at retaining the existing requirements for operating leases. I think performance obligation is actually off the table now. And they prefer to keep the current accounting.
Yep.
I'll qualify that in a minute. But whereas the ISB would prefer a derecognition model. By that, it's a partial derecognition model. You take out of your books the piece or the portion of the asset that you're transferring over to the other party. So that's the difference fundamentally. But at least we had a look through. We thought it would be helpful for the staff if we went through and said, well, if we did have a derecognition model, what would we do? And so you derecognize a portion of the carrying amount of the underlying asset. So that kind of deals with the upfront profit recognition. It's a mechanical way of working at how much to derecognize. You would record the residual value as an allocation of that carrying amount initially, and then you would accrete up from there. So we've at least looked at that accounting, but we're going to have to come back and see whether or not we, I guess it's a clear choice between this partial derecognition or retaining existing operating lease accounting. Now, even if we do retain operating lease accounting, I think both boards realise that it's not just a matter of retaining existing requirements in US GAAP and IFRS's. We would have to align the terminology with the lessee side, so we'd actually be pulling into a new standard. I guess the ideas that are embedded in our IS 17, but make sure that the terminology and things are the same and line up. So that's a little bit more work for us to do on that as well. There are a couple more issues there. I guess the other things that we had a look at were to do with reassessment of options. So this is where you've got a lease, where you've got a renewal option. The exposure draft was essentially had a very low threshold, so that you might have to reassess quite. So you'd look at the lease term, and you might have two or three renewals, and you looked at the likelihood of reassessment, quite a low threshold. So people fed back to us that they didn't think that was appropriate, that they would be forced to basically look out over quite a long term, when in fact they were retaining flexibility. They could, if they chose to, walk away. And so we looked at the language to try and get the right sort of threshold, and it's essentially when it, I don't want to say economic compulsion, but it's close to that, whether or not we should have quite a high threshold in there, so that we're trying to capture the situation where, you know, somebody leases puts in a lease agreement, and this parts and equipment, for example, that's bolted down inside this factory, and they can't do anything else about it. And so it's clearly they're going to renew this thing.
Yeah.
And we're trying to get the right words around that. And at the moment, it's quite a close vote. 8-6 on our side, and we had one absence, unfortunately, this week. It was a very close vote. And having a look at significant economic incentives to exercise the option. So I think some of our board would prefer that we didn't go, that don't think we've raised the hurdle high enough, and they're very concerned that if you just happen to think that you've got a shop, for example, in a good location, then that's a good economic incentive to renew, and you're going to renew, therefore you should look out for quite a long term. And so, you know, just because it's a good place now doesn't mean it's going to be a good place to have your shop next time. So I think that there's a sense among both boards that we don't want this to be a low hurdle. It's going to come down to a lot of it will be drafting, and I think you know, the staff will probably bring that as part of our sweep issues back to make sure that we've captured what the boards are like. One other little thing, discount rates. There are two things. This is, again, if you reassess the discount rate, the two situations. One is linked back to that last decision I mentioned, and that's when you have a change in lease payments due to a change in the assessment of whether the lessee is a significant incentive. In other words, when the lessor has a perception that the lessee will actually renew, and therefore they change what they're booking in, in their financial statements, do you then reassess the discount rate? A very close vote. Again, our board was 9-5, although FASB was 6-0 in favour of doing that at the time you made that reassessment. If there's a change because of a change in lease payments because an option's been exercised, that's a different kettle of fish because you've actually got a new contract. So that was a much clearer vote in favour of doing that.
Okay, lots of leases. Revenue recognition, where are we now on that, Steve?
Well, we're getting towards the end, we've had some very good progress on this. We spent a fair bit of time talking about disclosures in this session. We also talked about onerous contracts and contract acquisition and fulfillment costs. On the disclosures, I'm not going to go through the full list of the disclosures that we confirmed, but we largely confirmed the disclosures which were in the exposure draft. We made some changes. For example, in terms of disaggregation and the categories in which revenue should be sort of separated, we decided that the revenue standard shouldn't prescribe the specific categories into which you should disaggregate revenue, but leave that more flexible. That we should disaggregate either in the statement of comprehensive income or the notes. And we decided that we shouldn't disaggregate the impairment loss allowance. So that sort of minor changes in those areas, making it a little bit more flexible in that particular case, is an example of the changes that we've made. But as I say, a lot of the disclosures were confirmed. There has been there was criticism of the ED in terms of disclosure overload, so we will have to look at the whole package when we come to the drafting. I think certainly the disclosures were very well supported by many people, particularly the users. And we didn't want to lose, obviously, the important information that's there. In terms of contract acquisition costs, we are requiring now the capitalization of contract acquisition costs that meet certain criteria. There was some concern at that decision that it would place a burden on companies who had short-term contracts of having to capitalize these costs and then expense them over a very short period, which of course would have little practical impact, but potentially enormous systems impact. So as a practical expedient, we tentatively decided that for contracts with a duration of 1 year or less, then we should permit the entity to recognize contract acquisition costs as an expense when incurred, rather than have to capitalize them. So that's more of a cost-benefit type adjustment. We also had an issue with onerous contracts. The onerous contract test that we had inserted may be interpreted to be applied at a lower level of unit of account than the contract as a whole. And the example that we discussed was selling airline tickets. And you may sell some of the airline tickets very cheaply. And prior to selling all of the tickets, you could argue that There's an onerous contract for the sale of the first ticket because, of course, you're going to be flying the plane and incur all these costs. So we had to deal with that potential problem with the onerous contract test. And the way we've decided to do it is to limit the application of the onerous test to performance obligation that an entity satisfies over time, long-term service contracts. And that, we think, will then solve that particular problem. And that's about it. The staff are working on the drafting of the final standard right now. But Alan, what's the decision about the timing on that?
Well, the next thing for this is that we're going to be producing a staff draft. And what we'll be doing is placing a staff draft up onto our public website. Mm-hmm. The idea is it'll be a full draft of the proposed final standard, including the basis for conclusions. And we're going to spend a bit of time then in what I would call a review, I guess, in that it's not a... Well, we still have... The boards haven't even looked at re-exposure yet. They've still got to make that decision. And we'll do that probably in June. We'll actually have a look at all the decisions they've made, look at the package and see whether or not a re-exposure is required. If it's not, we'll go ahead with a staff draft and a review process, essentially a very intensive fatal flaw review process. And it's to do to make sure that we don't have these things. You know, Steve mentioned this one about the onerous test, onerous contract test, where you sell one ticket for a show. Are you going to? Is it onerous because you might not make a profit on the show? It's not. That was an unintended consequence, and so we want to make sure that we don't have that sort of thing appearing in there. It won't be a review of the decisions. It'll be a review of the drafting to make sure that we've captured and people can actually work with the words we've got. So that we're looking at around about the end of June to have that process start. So we people have plenty of time to provide us with feedback because quality matters in this.
Yep.
Financial instruments inevitably were on the agenda. Alan, do you want to give us a brief guide to what happened on offsetting?
Well, it's this is a very small session this time. We've just. Our comment period closed on the offsetting exposure draft, where the ISB and FASB had a joint exposure draft. As you'll recall, this is one of the biggest differences in terms of the way people present financial assets and liabilities. Without oversimplifying, with US GAAP, the ability to offset is much easier to offset as under US GAAP than it is under IFRS's. So a US GAAP balance sheet can have for identical transactions could be much smaller in terms of it shows net the assets or gross assets are smaller, gross liabilities are smaller, whereas IFRS is again you'd show probably bigger amounts, the gross amounts. The exposure draft was looking to try to bridge that difference and come up with a common solution. The feedback was mixed. It's fair to say it was a lot of it's geographical lines, but you can imagine that because if you're used to presenting your balance sheet in a particular way, to be asked to change, of course, you're going to ask for us to justify the change.
Yep.
So there were no decisions made on this because essentially this was asking the boards to have a look at the comment letter summaries, and we did a very extensive outreach on this. So again, through around the world, and get a sense of the feedback. Now, what we'll be doing is that the staff will start to bring that back over the next few weeks to explore how much of the exposure draft we want to retain, with a view to getting a common solution, and perhaps over the next couple of months.
Excellent, Steve. Impairment.
Impairments is a difficult subject, and it's been going for some time now. We had original exposure drafts that both the FASB and the ISB put out, which were different. They were both an expected loss, more forward-looking model, but it had a different approach. We then got together towards the end of last year to try and come to a converged model. We did produce this converged exposure draft proposing a single model. However, it was essentially the simplified versions of the two original models bolted together. And as a consequence, it was difficult to justify some of the things we were in there on the conceptual terms. The boards recognized that, but they wanted to get something out to get further public comment. There was some support for it, but there were significant problems conceptually, but also definitions of foreseeable future and how that would work, good book, bad book, split. Perhaps the clearest message, though, that we got from that exposure draft was that we should have a converged solution, that having different approaches under IFRS and US GAAP would be very difficult to justify. So we're very well aware of that, and we are working hard together to try and reach such a converged solution. Now, we didn't take any decisions at this meeting. It was a summary of the comment letter feedback that was presented by staff. And what we do need to do now is to consider how we're going to react to this. I think the boards recognized that there were some good things in what we proposed, both in this document and in the earlier documents. And we need to find a way forward to reach a converged solution that is forward-looking, is based around expected losses, but that doesn't have some of the drawbacks that have been present in the documents that we've produced so far. And it's a challenge for us to come to that. So we're going to consider the way forward. Staff will bring proposals back to the board, hopefully in the near term, for us to consider. So I'm afraid I can't give any sort of further indication right now as to what that might be, but hopefully we can get to a converged solution soon. Mm.
But sooner rather than later, because I was just doing the agenda for... We've got extra board meetings coming up again at the end of this month, Robert, on the 30th of May, 1st and 2nd of June. And we have two slots, I think, on the 30th of May and 1st of June to discuss the impairment model. Mm. So we're hopeful. We've got joint team, basically, the ISB and FASB, working together on that with a view to getting papers back fairly soon.
Okay. Anything else? You've just covered the next meeting. Anything else coming up?
One more. In our last podcast we mentioned we just put out a package of standards, but got another one coming up. We've got some amendments with IAS 1, which is our presentation of financial standards statements standard, and we've got some amendments related to how you present other comprehensive income, and we're expecting to put that out towards the end of this month, so either the last day in May or first day in June. So
we should look forward to that.
Indeed, I hope they look forward to it.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve. Thank you very much, Alan. Finally, the official disclaimer. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and are not necessarily the official views of the ISB. For full details of deliberations at the board meeting, please go to the ISB website. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.